All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. Oh. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true!
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined, as always, by my partner in all things strategery and jackassery, Elliot Cohen, who is the Professor Emeritus of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributor to The Atlantic, and returning from gallivanting in the Adirondacks and the Great White North in Canada. Elliot, how are you on this beautiful fall day?
Well, it is a beautiful fall day. I think we should make it very clear to our listeners that we do the strategery. We only report on the jackassery.
Fair enough.
It was great. I want to talk a little bit about Canada later on in the podcast. We had a wonderful time. We were in Ottawa and in Quebec, and I think there's some serious issues which may be coming down the pike that we can talk about. But let's plunge right into the jackasseries. And as always, the week is filled with them. I have two, and as you know, I try to be fair and balanced. So I'm going to begin with one on the right, and that is our vice president at an event at the University Turning Point USA event at the University of Mississippi. A young guy wearing a MAGA hat comes up and says the following. I'm a Christian man, and I'm just confused why there's this notion that we might owe Israel something, or that they're our greatest ally, or that we have to support this multi-$100 billion foreign aid package to Israel to cover this. To quote Charlie Kirk, ethnic cleansing in Gaza. I'm just confused why this idea has come around, considering the fact that not only does their religion not agree with ours, but openly supports the prosecution of ours. I think the kid meant persecution. And of course, there's no multi-$100 billion foreign aid budget. But what's striking is J.D. Vance's response. And in his response, he says, yeah, well, Jews don't believe in Jesus Christ as the Messiah. We should have those conversations. We have theological disagreements, as if this is like a public policy, you know, debate of some sort. And then he goes on to say, well, what I really care about is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And then he goes off into America First. What he didn't do, of course, is to say, well, hang on a second. The Jews are not persecuting Christians. And that is not the road you go down. You know, I always think of John McCain during his ill-fated campaign against Barack Obama when, you know, somebody in the audience said something pretty harsh about Obama. And he goes, no. He's my opponent. He's not my enemy. He's a fine human being. And, you know, that was what a principled and gracious person did. And Vance,
he's not a secret Muslim, which is what I think the woman was accusing Obama of being.
And of course, Vance just, you know, he completely whiffed. He hasn't apologized for it. He hasn't said anything about it. And I think it shows you what kind of, not only what kind of politician he is, I think it's what kind of human being he is.
Now, no, Elliot, before you go to your second jackassery of the week, if I could on this, I'd like to, you know, revise and extend your remarks, because I think it goes to something we talked about last week, which is the, you know, the growing kind of GOP Nazi problem. And, you know, because it's not, I would say, an accident, as I might have said in an earlier phase of my career, comrade, that, you know, this week as well, Tucker Carlson had Nick Fuentes on his show and platformed him. And there are, to their credit, there are some people who have responded to this, like Rod Dreher. There are some conservatives who have been appalled by this, as they should be. But it's really notable, and I think it tells you something, that Kevin Roberts, the president of the Heritage Foundation, thought it was not only appropriate but necessary for him to go out and say that the rumors that Heritage has been trying to distance itself from Tucker Carlson, no, 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 we defend Tucker Carlson and his right to ask questions, et cetera. And, this to me just is a mark of the increasing bankruptcy of a lot of the Republican mainstream, conservative ink mainstream, in pushing back against this really dangerous efflorescence of out and out Nazism, you know, kind of in their midst and in their ranks. I mean, we'll get to talk about some of the ideological origins of this next week when we have Laura Field on the show talking about her book Furious Minds about the MAGA intellectual establishment. And there's a lot of it going on there as well. But this is very dangerous. And I do want to, give, props to Senator Ted Cruz, who actually called this out today.
Ted Cruz did call it out, and I was going to say I do give him a lot of credit for that. And he called it out very publicly as well. Look, I think one of the things that this brings home to me is people like Tucker Carlson are not conservatives, because indeed the Nazis were not conservatives. They were revolutionaries. Rod Dreher is a conservative. I would say Ted Cruz is a conservative. And part of what we're seeing here is the world is no longer divided between liberals and conservatives, or if you prefer, progressives and conservatives. But there's radicalism on both sides. And in both cases, it takes the form of anti-Semitism. I think in a particularly open and virulent way at the moment on the right, but it's there on the left. We're now a little bit past some of the stuff that was going on the campuses, particularly places like Columbia, but not just Columbia, which, were palpably anti-Semitic. And I think it was just, and I think this week as well, there was a great sort of video clip with Larry Summers calling Harvard to account on this front as well. So it's part there. I mean, anti-Semitism is a vast subject. But I guess all I'll say here is, to use a cliche, which happens to be true, the Jews are the canary in the coal mine. And one of the things that radicals at either end of the spectrum tend to do is, for a whole bunch of reason, to go after the Jews. And unfortunately, in this case, we're particularly at the moment, we're seeing a lot of it on the right, but it's absolutely there on at the other end of the spectrum as well. And it is an ominous sign, and we have to be wary of it.
There's a responsibility for the leaders of the mainstream of both sides of the aisle in terms of parties, but also both political dispensations, if you will, to basically police their own. And one of the things from a historical point of view, and I think, I know I've mentioned it on previous episodes, one of the major accomplishments of liberalism in the United States during the Cold War period was the policing of the left and basically relegating the Communist Party and fellow travelers, kind of beyond the pale of legitimate political discourse. And there's been, in my view, a stunning failure on the part of the right to do this. And we've talked in the past, on this show and with, with Jacob Heilbrun and others, about the efforts that Buckley made, to read the Birchers out of the Republican Party. There's been nothing like that this time around, and it's I think it's bad for the health of the body politic.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, there's been a rather critical biography of Buckley by Sam Tannenhaus, and I was talking to somebody about it. And I said, look, I knew Buckley. Buckley, early on in his career, starts out with some very unsavory positions on Jews, on African Americans, and he moved. And by the kind of late middle and end of his career, when very good friends of his of long standing began saying anti-Semitic things, he said, okay, that's it. This is a break. And you're not going to be able to publish in my magazine at all. And this is not acceptable. And you're right. And the policing has to be done to both sides. In that connection, it was, I guess, more than a little bit disturbing that you heard, yeah, some people in the Democratic Party saying, oh, well, so what's the name? Graham Platner, the Democratic candidate for Senate in Maine, has a Totenkopf, sort of skull and crossbones insignia on his chest. And he had no idea, supposedly, that this had certain historical resonances. And everybody said, oh, why does everybody get so excited by all this? Well, there's a reason for it. So what I wanted to do was, as one more piece of jackassery, and I suppose you could say that this is on the left. So once again, to my alma mater, Harvard, where the Office of Undergraduate Education put out a report, which, however, you cannot access unless you're part of the Harvard community, on grade inflation. So it turns out that 60% of all undergraduate grades at Harvard are A's. Now, by the way, when I was...
I'm amazed it's that low.
Well, Yale is worse.
Right.
Apparently. I just say that because you're Yale.
Yes, I know.
here's the thing. So the Harvard Crimson did a pretty good job, as they often do, of reporting, talking to student reactions. And basically the report says, this is a real problem. We've got to find a way to fix it. So a student reacted to the report, quote, "The whole entire day I was crying. I skipped classes on Monday, and I was just sobbing in bed because I felt like I try so hard in my classes and my grades aren't even the best." Probably means A minuses rather than A's. And there's a whole series of these things, the students saying, oh, this is going to have a terrible effect on mental health. And some of the faculty say, well, clearly the solution is we should give A pluses, which is a grade that never existed at Harvard. Again, just for the record, my grading standard was no more than about 3 or 4% of the grades were A's, you know, maybe 10% A minuses, because otherwise the grades are meaningless. But it's what disturbed me about that is this does tell you something deep about academic culture and the rot of standards, and also the way in which we have a younger generation that really, whether through coddling or through a belief system that you can't have stressful or kinds of tests or circumstances, and that everybody gets to be outstanding, that they think it's okay to say, yeah, no, I skipped all my classes and just lay in my bed sobbing. I mean, Harvard has historically prided itself on providing leaders for the country. And would you want somebody like that leading you? I don't think so.
Yeah. I mean, I think we can stipulate, I think it's pretty easy to say that grade inflation is not merely a problem at Harvard. It's a problem, across academia. And certainly the notion that, universities are Lake Wobegon and everybody is above average, is pretty clear to anyone who's had anything to do with universities over the last 20, 30, 40 years, sadly. I read the article and I was kind of appalled at the student reactions also. I mean, but, look, it's of a piece with what we see. It's not just grades. It's what we make students read. And the fact that increasingly faculty at universities across the country can't assign entire books because students are incapable of reading them, because it's too long. And that, I think, I mean, we're at risk, particularly with AI, of becoming a post-literate society. And I worry about the long-term consequences of that.
It's part of a broader problem, I think, on both left and right, though. And when we do some of our more culturally oriented episodes, we should dig into it. If people have trouble reading books on the left, they have trouble reading books on the right. If people feel they should be protected from stressful or difficult kinds of reactions to what they said or did, but we see that now on the right as well as on the left.
I mean, absolutely.
Really venomous reaction to anybody who was not quite sure that they were completely taken with Charlie Kirk is indicative. I mean, there's a deep irony, to go back to J.D. Vance, who I agree with you is a pretty appalling politician, when somebody who I'm sure complained a great deal about cancel culture said, well, if anybody said anything critical about Charlie Kirk, you should call their bosses and try to get them fired. So this is a deeper cultural thing, and unfortunately, I think it does span the political spectrum. But that wasn't even the biggest jackassery of the week. I think you have probably something bigger in store for us.
Time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the biggest jackassery of the week was the President of the United States, just before he met with Xi Jinping, sent out a post on Truth Social that said, because every other country is testing nuclear weapons, I've instructed the Department of War to immediately begin testing U.S. nuclear weapons. We have the biggest, baddest nuclear arsenal in the world, and we're going to show everybody, we're going to pop a couple of these babies off, et cetera. Of course, I'm exaggerating a bit for effect, but only slightly. The thing that was striking about it was that, every single fact adverted to in this post was wrong, which is to say, we do not have the largest nuclear arsenal. The Russians actually have numerically a larger arsenal than we do. He also asserted that the nuclear force had been thoroughly modernized and in his first term. Nuclear modernization, parts of it began during his first term, but not a single new delivery system was delivered. The testing he seems to be complaining about is obviously the well-advertised test of the Russian Burevestnik, this what some people derisively call, little flying Chernobyl, a nuclear-powered cruise missile that can stay aloft for 15 hours and can approach, the United States from the south rather than across the pole. And then more recently, the Poseidon nuclear-powered torpedo that Putin has advertised in the past, which is a completely useless weapon. And neither one of these weapons are, neither one is treaty accountable. And I'll come back to treaty in a second. But neither one of them really is one that worries me a lot, in the sense that they're stupid investments by the Russians in weapons that are not all that threatening to us. The Burevestnik could be under certain circumstances. The Poseidon's purely a post-strike revenge weapon. They're either going to, nuke Long Beach and Los Angeles, harbors with a warhead that'll leave them, radiating for 150 years. He also somehow was not apprised of the fact that nuclear testing is conducted by the Department of Energy, not the Department of Defense, although, as he insists, it's the Department of War, even though the Congress has not change the name. Literally everything, the other thing was that they're going to start nuclear testing immediately, even though NNSA, Department of Energy's National Nuclear Security Administration, has said that it would take 24 to 36 months and hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, to prepare the Nevada test site to actually begin testing again. So every specific of it was wrong. And what, to me, what that tells you is that the president's being extremely ill-served by the total lack of a national security decision-making process that can provide him with policy options, alternatives, and basic information about some of the most sensitive national security issues that any president has to address. So, and it is total jackassery, but you know, very, very serious at the same time. You know, I mentioned that many of these weapons, you know, that seem to have exercised the president quite a bit, are not treaty accountable under the New START treaty. By the same token, though, the president, who seems to have, you know, been bent out of shape about these things, when President Putin has raised in the last few weeks the idea of rolling over New START for a year when it expires in 2026 in February, for which there's no provision in the treaty, by the way. This would be a completely ad hoc arrangement and not subject, as far as we can tell, to any of the verification protocols of the treaty, which have been suspended by the Russians for a couple of years now. President said, oh yeah, that's an interesting idea. We might want to, maybe I could get Xi Jinping to, you know, sign on to this as well, which I think there's no chance of. But Frank Miller and I have written about this. We actually published something in National Review on earlier this week on the subject. I mean, signing on to this deal would be, you know, terrible for the U.S. It would constrain us, not constrain all these weapons that the president seemingly is very concerned about. And it would help, you know, Russia in the sense that it would keep us from going beyond the New START limits of 1,550 warheads. That we might need to deal with the unprecedented situation we face right now, which is we've got to deter two nuclear peers, not just one, because of all the buildup that China's undertaking.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key point there is the Chinese nuclear buildup, which is so substantial. Of course, I think what you were seeing here was Trump's inclination to be spontaneous. Sometimes I think with a view to throwing people off or rattling them or trolling them, but he applies that to foreign policy as well, where it's really not a very good idea. And as you say, not only is there no process, there's nobody around him who's going to say, Mr. President, don't say that. This is a dangerous thing. This has implications that you really need to think about. And I don't think any of this will get any better. Yeah, well, that's a week full of jackassery. For the first part of our, the next part of the conversation, I thought it might be interesting to talk a little bit about allies. I was thinking about this visiting Canada. And there are a couple of thoughts. First, you know, one thing that does occur to me is most Americans know very, very little about Canada. About Canadian history, at least. So there are plenty of Americans who go back and forth across the border, and they may watch hockey, and they probably consume lots of maple syrup. But in terms of knowing anything about the history of Canada or its politics, very, very little. And there are a couple of things that I think we should be paying attention to. Now, you know, on the one hand, the Canadians have, in certain respects, been quite extraordinary allies. A lot of people don't know a lot about the military history of Canada. During World War I and World War II, the Canadian military effort was quite extraordinary. On a population base in World War II of about 11.5 million, I think, you had 1 million Canadians enlist. The only draft that was introduced at the end for home service. Proportionate to population, they took twice our casualties. World War I is actually a similar story. So most of the ships being escorted across the North Atlantic during World War II were being escorted by the Royal Canadian Navy, and I could go on. Now, that's not what the Canadian military is like today. There was an internal Canadian report that said only about half of their equipment is serviceable. I mean, the Canadians have really let their military decay. I think they have four old British submarines. One of them can go out for like 2 months a year or something like that. They're supposed to be buying F-35s to replace their old F-18 Hornets. They're having trouble managing that. They are well below their target strength of, I think a total of about over 100,000 people in uniform. They're well below that. Part of the problem does go back to the Trudeau administration. And by that, I mean Justin Trudeau, although his father, Pierre Trudeau, who was prime minister, also has something to answer for. But Justin Trudeau famously said, there is no core identity, no mainstream in Canada. We are the first post-national state. And in a way, what that's done is to put Canada in a precarious position, because if your national identity becomes that you're nice, which is literally what he said. He said, you know, what we are is we're compassionate and kind. You are setting yourself up for a real problem of internal cohesion. One of the things that I heard when I was in Canada, and I did manage to have some political conversations, is people being convinced that the Parti Québécois, the Quebec Independence Party, will have another go in a year or two at independence. That's never been that far from people's minds. I have to say, when you go to Quebec, Quebec City is a much nicer city than Ottawa. Ottawa has some fantastic museums, particularly the Canadian War Museum, which I would warmly commend to anybody. But it's not much of a city. Quebec City is a magnificent city, and with a parliament. I mean, the Canadian parliament is very impressive. But actually, the Quebecois parliament is pretty impressive, too. And one of the things I came away worried about is we could actually end up making Canadian cohesion much more problematic in two ways. One is the tariffs, apparently, are having some effect on the location of factories in Canada. You know, that basically the U.S. and Canadian automotive industries are very tightly integrated. And, you know, before you drive your car, it's probably crossed the border, you know, literally dozens of times, just all the different components. Well, what I heard, I don't know if it's true, is that some companies are thinking about relocating factories from Canada to the United States because of the tariffs. That would be very disruptive and destabilizing. But the other thing is, given that Trump does have this crazy idea about somehow absorbing Canada into the United States, in the past, there have been repeated efforts by people who wanted to push for Quebec independence. One of the reasons why it's never happened is the United States has always leaned pretty hard on the inhabitants of Quebec to say, you know, we would not like that to happen. It's really not in your interests. I can easily imagine a Trump personally, and it is unfortunately a very personalistic kind of regime, encouraging it because he thinks that that could advance his broader scheme of somehow incorporating Canada, the United States. So those are some thoughts about Canada. But, you know, I did want to use this also as a way to open up a discussion of our allies, because I really believe that one of the things that's so damaging about Trump and about the MAGA movement, and you see it, by the way, in J.D. and just about any time J.D. Vance opens his mouth, is they have no idea what allies are really like and the complexity of dealing with allies and why you really want to have allies. I have to say, you feel that when you go to Canada. I mean, the relationship has changed. You know, I particularly wanted to ask you to talk about it because you played such a large role in rebuilding our relationship with France, which is our oldest, possibly our most frustrating ally. but a very, very important ally. So if I could draw you out on any of this, I'd be grateful.
First, let me just say, in my experience, Canadians are extremely nice. But also we're extremely good allies. And, you know, in particular, I know from my dealings with Canadian counterparts that, that they played a, you know, again, took disproportionate casualties in Afghanistan and were really stand up, when we were, you know, in, Afghanistan, particularly Rick Hilliard, who was the, the chief of defense back in those days, it was a great partner. To have, you know, allies, you know, the Churchill famously said the only thing worse than fighting a war, you know, with allies is trying to fight one without them. And a couple of weeks ago, when we had Tim Bouverie on, we talked, you know, quite a bit about the allies at war and, you know, how the World War II alliance, you know, kind of worked and how difficult it was. It's hard work. You know, if you read, as I had to when I was writing my own PhD dissertation, the records of the combined chiefs of staff arguing over, you know, North Africa or the invasion of Sicily or Italy. I mean, the fights, you know, among Americans and Brits were, you know, sometimes you thought they were so intense that they were greater than the, you know, fight against the adversaries. And it took some real statesmanship on the part of, you know, Sir John Dill and then later Alan Brooke and George Marshall to make all of this work. So, you know, what are alliances really about? I mean, so at one level, it's about aggregating power, and bringing, you know, more power onto your side than to the adversaries. To me, it just seems almost axiomatic that in a world where you've got Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran working together in this tightening, you know, dare I say it, access of adversaries or of upheaval or whatever you want to call it, that we're not capable of outweighing all of that in terms of population, productivity, ability to turn all of those things into usable military power on our own. We need, you know, allies. So number one, it's about, you know, aggregating power. I think the less recognized part of it is that alliances are also what, you know, the late historian Paul Schroeder called pacts of restraint. And by that, you know, when you're tied up in an alliance relationship, allies are always, particularly if you're an ally of the United States, which is, you know, a big power that George Kennan once described as like a big dinosaur. It's got a very big, strong body, but like a tiny pea brain. And, you know, it takes a lot of wax on the dinosaur by, you know, its enemies before the predator brain sort of, you know, sparks to life. And then it starts swinging its tail around and it knocks down the entire jungle. You know, it's useful to have allies who will restrain you, that, which is to say, allies are constantly worried you're going to abandon them, you know, on the one hand, or you're going to entrap them into a war. You're going to get them, you know, into a war they don't want to fight. And you see that all the time in our own alliances. And it's one reason why, now you're going to get me inveighing against academic international relations. You know, the theory of, you know, most neorealist theories of international relations basically, you know, argue that because there's this homeostatic tendency of the system to always want to be in balance, that you don't really have to do much, you know, to maintain your alliances, because, you know, countries naturally are going to want to balance rather than bandwagon with adversaries. I mean, you know, you were in government with me. I mean, in my experience, almost no one in government believes that. They're constantly worried that because of this fear of abandonment, fear of entrapment, you know, Scylla and Charybdis, through which statesmen and women have to navigate, that allies are always, you know, fearful that you won't be there for them. And it's the reason why my former late boss, George Shultz, used to say, you know, alliance management is like gardening. You constantly have to attend to it. And although, you know, I think the predisposition of most folks in Washington is to see the UK, or until recently anyway, the UK as our closest ally, the special relationship, the deputy sheriff, what have you. George Shultz always used to say, God, the French are such a pain in the ass. They're really a pain to deal with. But he said that, you know, when you go to Paris and you talk to them, they're our only ally that actually has a global view of things. Right. Which I think is true. And so allies can help you kind of navigate things better than you might if left to your own devices. I think in some cases in the war on terror, we shortchanged our allies and didn't pay enough attention to them when they warned us of different kinds of things, particularly allies who had experience in parts of the world we were going into. But I also think that, you know, you could think of instances where, and I think of the Korean War in particular, where, you know, voices started to be raised early in the war. We should use nuclear weapons.
Right. And the Brits said no.
And the Brits were terrified about this for good reason, good and sufficient reason. And Clement Attlee, when Harry Truman said ill-advisedly at a press conference that everything was on the table, maybe we'd use nuclear weapons. Clement Attlee was in Washington 48 hours later, you know, kind of pulling us in a different direction. You've seen that at work with Trump, you know, and Trump's efforts to sort of lean towards Russia, put, you know, pressure on Ukraine, and you've then seen the allies kind of pull together and try and get Trump back kind of on online. So, you know, look, I thought the disruption to our relationship with France was unfortunate, and I did put a lot of effort into in the last 2 years I was in government to try and you were a big part of that. You know, going to Paris, you know, talking with our counterparts and, you know, working together, and, you know, paid off. The French made a major commitment to Afghanistan while all this was going on and helped us there. So, you know, it's always, you know, gardening takes a lot of time and effort. I'm not particularly good at it, you know, when it comes to growing green things. My wife is much better, but I think that we have lost a little bit, you know, in the post-Cold War era of our touch as diplomats doing that, in part because we were so powerful, and the disproportion between our power and that of our allies was so great that we kind of lost a bit of our, you know, our game, our fastball at doing this, which I think we honed during the Cold War pretty effectively. And I think we need to get back to it. Unfortunately, MAGA and America First has kind of gotten in the way, and I think delayed our ability to do that.
Yeah. I would only add to that that one of the problems with that, what you described as the homeostatic view, the idea that the system just works on its own, and so there's really no role for diplomacy, actually, because it's all completely automatic, which is a very simple-minded view, which a lot of very simple-minded political science professors believe in. People fail to understand the role that institutional relationships and sort of networks of personal relationships play in this. So, yes, you had some real tension between Jacques Chirac and George W. Bush and Helmut Schmidt and George W. Bush. But meanwhile, you know, you have the intelligence.
I think you mean Gerhard Schroeder.
I did mean Gerhard Schroeder. I'm sorry. Although there were some moments actually with Helmut Schmidt too over.
Yeah, that was the Carter, and those were very serious tensions also.
But the point is, you know, you have these relationships, you know, between the intelligence communities, between the military communities, among the diplomatic community. And those networks of relationships, which frequently persist even when there's a great deal of acrimony at the top, are very, very important to keep things going. This is one of the things that I believe Trump does not understand, because he, like, to be fair, like many political leaders, he thinks it's all about his personal relationship with Xi Jinping or Macron or Keir Starmer, doesn't understand that there's this web of connections. But I think there's another element too, which is that values are not irrelevant to how alliances function. And I use values in a very broad sense. It's not like, do we believe in the rule of law? That's actually very important. But it also means various kinds of cultural connections and those kinds of things. And once again, the temptation, I believe, if you conceive of yourself as a hard-headed realist, is to think, well, those things don't matter. They do. They matter a lot. You know, again, as you and I was always struck by this, watching you talk with our French counterparts, one of whom I was actually visiting in Ottawa, who senses very best, made a difference that you knew French literature and could talk about it, or French history. And so those kinds of things are quite deep. Now, having said that, I also think it's complicated. So, you know, for example, in Canada, you would hear people say, well, we'll never trust you again. And we have this beautiful relationship and it's shattered forever. Well, you know, the truth is that there's always been this deep Canadian anxiety about the United States for good reason. We've invaded them several times. And they were afraid that we were going to invade them at least through the 1870s and arguably even through the late 1890s, and indeed Canadian Confederation in 1867 in the British North America Act was a result of the British withdrawal of the military from continental part of Canada. And they said, okay, you know, we better do something here. Otherwise, there's a good chance that we'll kind of fall into the arms of the United States. So I guess the larger point here is that these relationships are indeed very complicated, multifaceted. They never get simply ruptured. But as you say, you have to be continually working at that. And to be able to do that, you actually do need to develop some deep knowledge about your allies. And I share your worry that that's not what we tend to have these days. I don't think our diplomats have it in the way that they used to. And for sure, the general public doesn't. So allies. Lots of other stuff going on.
Yeah, let's talk about Venezuela here for a minute. You know, the strikes on, you know, alleged narco-terrorist traffickers, both in the Caribbean and now increasingly, because I think there are fewer targets in the Caribbean, in the Eastern Pacific, we've talked about before, but it's kind of reaching a crescendo. I mean, we've got this huge flotilla down there now. Gerald Ford has been sent down from the Eastern Med to the Caribbean. I mean, nothing going on in the Eastern Med. Why would we want to have forces there? I mean, I think we're now up to almost 20% of our deployed naval assets are down in the Caribbean, and increasing discomfort in the Congress. Today, two letters that have been sent, one in September, one early October, by Chairman Roger Wicker and ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Jack Reed, to the administration, demanding to understand what the legal basis is. I mean, allegedly, there's an Office of Legal Counsel memo in the Justice Department that justifies this. But how this fits under the law of armed conflict is anybody's guess. I mean, the most expert people I've seen opining about this don't see how it could possibly fit under that. So what we are doing is basically engaging in extrajudicial murder. As Adam Smith, the ranking Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, saying we don't have the death penalty in a lot of places in the country for drug trafficking. Maybe we should have that, debate as a public policy matter. But, you know, in the absence of that, we're using military force to do this in a way that's very inappropriate. And in particular, I've been concerned that if you read the press, the Washington Post had a big story about how there's a lot of concern in the Pentagon by people who are in the chain of command about whether these orders are legal and whether any, you know, buddy from the Judge Advocate General Corps has signed off on these things. And my concern is that inuring officers to the idea that, you know, they may be asked to carry out illegal orders and doing it is not healthy for the Republic. Susan Glasser was soliciting from a number of people, and she's now put out a tweet with all the list of folks who she asked, you know, what was the most shocking thing that the administration has done? And when I answered her, I said this. And in particular, I pointed out that this was a very big concern for the founders, you know, almost all of whom had read Molesworth's History of Denmark as it was in 1692, which was a proof text for the danger of standing armies. We have a professional army now, and having them carrying out repeatedly, illegal orders or orders that whose legality is highly questionable is, I think, a real danger to the, you know, continuation of our democratic republic.
I completely agree with that. One thing people might want to do is look at the Bill of Particulars in the Declaration of Independence and look how much of it is about the misuse of military power, including on the high seas, because they talk about impressment, and, among other things. There's another angle to this as well. As you know, I've been finishing a book on strategy, and it's built around the idea of seven big questions. The seventh, and in some ways the most important question, is what is your theory of victory? And here it's very hard to figure out what the theory of victory is. Is it that, did you have no more drug smuggling into the United States? Although actually a lot of these drugs are going to Europe. That's not plausible. Among other things, it's going to continue to come over the southern border. Is it that you overthrow the Maduro regime? The theory of victory is my story for how what we are doing gets us to where we want to be. Maybe this does get you to the overthrow of Maduro with a coup, conceivably. But that's not something you can count on. Meanwhile, as we've discussed, there are people talking about land operations in Venezuela, or at least attacks on land. I do think one of the challenges with contemporary American military power, and somebody like Trump is particularly susceptible to this, and it's something actually I wrote about many years ago after the first Gulf War, it's the temptation of precision air power, which has just gotten better and better. I mean, it is amazing. You can take out a particular boat and with really good intelligence, although sooner or later you'll have bad intelligence and you'll take out a fishing boat. You can think that you can wage a completely antiseptic kind of war where you're not going to have anybody in harm's way. And you'll be able to just plink away at somebody from a distance. And I just don't think that that's ever true. And look, in the case of the narco traffickers that you're dealing with, they actually have very considerable resources. They have resources which are comparable to those of a state. They can be, they're technologically very creative, actually. If, you know, I've seen some of, as I'm sure you have, some of these submarines, which they've been using for quite, they were, well, semi-submersibles, not entirely submarines, although I think they now have real submarines. They can have access to manned portable missiles, surface-to-air missile systems. They may end up trying to do stuff in the United States, which they undoubtedly have the networks to be able to do. And I would like to think that there's a campaign plan here, but I don't believe it. I mean, I don't believe that there's some sort of well-thought-through plan which says this is how we're going to get from point A to point B, and instead of we're just going to blow stuff up. And I guess the last thing I would say on this is that I do think Trump, one of the ways Trump tends to think about his achievements in foreign affairs is in terms of scalps that he's collected. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if some of this goes back to Obama getting Osama bin Laden and him wishing that it had been he who had been able to do that and order, you know, the elimination of some arch terrorist. But scalp hunting is not the same thing as strategy or a way of really resolving a problem. It's the search for trophies, that's all.
Yeah, I mean, so if regime change is the objective, the mechanism by which it's going to be accomplished is is eluding me. I mean, you know, the idea seems to be if we turn up the heat enough, you know, Maduro might just get the, you know, he might be so frightened of the idea that we might either try and, you know, snatch and grab him with, you know, special forces or, and take him to the United States to stand trial. He is an indicted, you know, narcotics trafficker. And like Manuel Noriega, maybe they think, you know, he could be brought to trial in the United States. And in the face of that, he's just going to resign and go to China or Russia, you know, like Assad. Okay, maybe. The other possibility seems to be, you know, one of the generals, all of whom are kind of implicated in all of this narco trafficking anyway, that one of the generals, as you say, takes him out in a coup or kills him and takes power. How are you any better off if you got Maduroism without Maduro? I just don't quite get it. There seems to be an enormous allergy to actually talking about the Democratic opposition, which they did talk about in the first term.
Yes.
And trying to put the Democratic opposition into power. It seems like to me, it's what the British historian Brendan Sims sometimes calls strategic Micawberism. You know, it's the idea of Mr. Micawber and Dickens, who keeps hoping that something will come along to, you know, change his fortunes. You know, this is a policy which is, well, if we turn up the heat, something will happen and it'll be good. And I just don't see how it, you know, is going to end well.
I have to say that there's also an incentive here for China, but certainly for Russia, to try to provide at least some capabilities to the Venezuelans, which would inflict some hurt on us. If you think about it, it would be smart from their point of view, because particularly if you're the Russians, say, hey, look, ATACMS have been killing Russian soldiers. So because you said that you're helping Ukraine defend itself, well, we're helping Venezuela defend itself. And if we respond to that sort of thing in a big way in Venezuela, then given Latin America's historical views of the use of American military power in Latin America, it becomes a big problem for us in our own hemisphere, quite apart from possibly having the advantage, again, from the Russian and Chinese point of view, of sucking us into some sort of conflict inside Venezuela itself, which could end up being pretty messy. So there's very little that seems promising here.
Yeah, I mean, just to, in terms of scale, we did this in 1989 with Manuel Noriega in Panama, where we went in, but I mean, it's totally different. I mean, the scale is different in terms of the size of the country, the size of the population, the potential for blowback. And we had all sorts of, we knew the canal, you know, we knew the canal zone in Panama very well from, you know, a hundred years of having been present there. It's just, you know, Venezuela is just not in any way, shape or form the same kind of task.
But even then, I remember talking to a colonel who had been involved in that operation. He said, it just amazed me to see the 82nd Airborne Division just disappear into Panama City. In other words, that it's urban warfare of a kind, which takes a lot of people. Remember also the Panamanian forces were a lot smaller, a lot less armed and prepared, and Venezuela probably would be different. I mean, there'd be plenty of people who I'm sure would welcome Americans as liberators, and there would also probably be plenty of people who'd be willing to pick up an AK and begin taking pot shots at us.
Yeah. We're getting a little short on time. I do want to at least briefly touch on the president's trip to Asia. You know, for my money, this was the, you know, arsonist as firefighter. I mean, you know, so the president kind of, you know, slapped all these tariffs on the Chinese. You know, trade wars are easy and, you know, easy to win. And then the Chinese, you know, kind of cut us off from rare earth minerals, which are, you know, incredibly important to the defense industrial base supply chain, for important, consumer items like laptops and you know, smartphones, et cetera. And the Chinese control the, you know, bulk of this. And then the administration sort of flails around and sends the president out there, and he comes back with, as he said, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, a 12, grading his own homework. You know, you want to talk about grade inflation. I mean, that's pretty inflated grade. But what did he get? You know, a small reduction of tariffs for a one-year deal on, you know, on rare earths, and the same kind of promises to buy more soybeans from the United States that he got in the trade deal in his first term that the Chinese didn't abide by. I mean, am I missing something, or is this just all smoke and mirrors?
He dug himself a hole that filled it in and pats himself on the back for having filled in the hole that he created. On the way back, he skipped the APEC meeting, which is probably the most important Asian gathering. And so he left the field totally open for Xi Jinping, who was there. And of course, Xi Jinping can make himself look like the sober, reasonable, non-crazy person who just wants to trade with you, isn't going to ask difficult questions about human rights or anything. So it, I think, again, that's something that's very typical of him. Just on rare earths, a good friend of mine who's a China scholar recently said to me, he said, look, the thing to remember about rare earths is they're not rare. It's just we stopped digging them up and producing them. They are out there in the United States, in Australia, and lots of other places. They are kind of messy and dirty to get at, which is one of the reasons why we've shut all that stuff down. But this is not a permanent lock that the Chinese have on us. The other thing, though, that I think is really interesting here, and we should have somebody into who's more expert to discuss this with us. We are finally, I think, really in the era of geoeconomics, where people are using economic tools for geopolitical purposes. And I think the judgment of a lot of people who have some claim to expertise in this is the Chinese have actually gotten to be quite good at it, that they've been quite good at figuring out what are the pain points in the United States, as have other people. We had, beginning in the Bush administration, tremendous success with the use of economic sanctions and leverage that were targeted. And it became, in many ways, a coercive weapon of choice. And it was always, I think, bound to be a matter of time before other people said, well, two can play at that game. And they began to figure out what some of the countermeasures are. Now, simply because of the size of our economy, we still have a great deal of leverage, but we're now in a world where the Chinese, A, have the leverage, and B, have the will to use it as well. And they're not the only ones. So I think that's a somewhat ominous sign for the future. But again, this was a case of Trump taking a victory lap over just about anything that he does, which also, by the way, makes it much harder for him to then revisit something and say, no, this is not working out well, and we have to go back to a more confrontational posture.
Well, on that happy note about the sort of demise of the trading order and the failures of American diplomacy, we'll have to wrap up this episode of Shield of the Republic, but we're operating in a target-rich environment, so I know we'll be back next week to talk about more.
Oh, well, there'll be plenty to discuss. And don't forget cultural rot. We talked about cultural rot, too.
Well, there's that, too.